To a new generation of Americans born in this century, tempered by war.
Well, I was so thrilled to be in Washington, I felt kind of guilty about being here in the first place. So I was knocking myself out to justify his faith in me.
This is Barney Ross, shipmate and friend of the late president.
Actually, his bringing me to Washington was a good example of what he was always preaching, was that one man can make a difference, that you really ought to try.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy, one man who made a difference.
Monitor presents a special tribute to the late President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. Eight Who Knew Him. Your host is Frank Blair.
When is a life important? When its seed is planted? When the warmth of love nourishes its growth? When it is cultivated by the stimulation of curiosity? When its intellect begins to flower? Or when it is cut down before it has truly ripened? John Fitzgerald Kennedy's life began on a Tuesday, May 29th, 1917. He was the second child and the second son of Joseph Patrick Kennedy and Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy, the grandson of a handsome, ambitious Boston Irish dock worker who accumulated enough to buy a string of saloons, a wholesale liquor business, a coal company, and a bank. That would seem like legacy enough, for it gave John Fitzgerald Kennedy's father, Joseph, the first brick which he used to construct a fortune. But money to the Kennedys was mere wherewithal. The real legacy passed down from generation to generation can't be reduced to double-entry bookkeeping. It is something difficult even for close Kennedy friends to describe. Here is Lemoyne Billings, a boyhood friend of the late president who spent many weekends and summers with the Kennedy family.
I was probably exposed to their father a great deal. Now, I have tremendous admiration for Mr. Kennedy, and I do not because so much of his great success in the world of business and also in government, but I have respect for him because I don't know anybody that has cared so much and yet done such a wonderful job in raising his children. And I think many people that have read about Mr. Kennedy or even might have known Mr. Kennedy think that perhaps he was cold and unemotional, but actually this is wrong. Mr. Kennedy was not cold and far from unemotional. And his one great drive, I think, and really what was, I know, the most important thing in his life was his children. He wanted so much to have them know and be interested in what was going on around them and what was going to happen in this world that we had to live in. I think, and on the other hand, he was very anxious for his children to be competitive and to win at games. And this, I think, makes Mr. Kennedy one of a truly great men, much more so than what he accomplished for himself.
Another friend, Charles Spalding, who remembers meeting John Fitzgerald Kennedy as a young man.
It was in the summer of 1940. I went to visit my roommate, George Meade, on the Cape, and we were on the way back to his house late one afternoon when he suggested we stop off and see the Kennedys. I remember it was about dinner time, and the house was filled with children, and there was an incredible racket as everybody got ready for supper. As we walked up to the house, heads appeared in various windows, and a lot of cheerful insults were thrown at us as we walked toward the house. Things like, "It's very interesting you're showing up just before supper," and "Sorry, there's no room at the inn. Keep going." Well, we went into the house and down to the president's room, which was on the first floor. He was sitting there, surrounded by some stacks of books of Why England Slept, which was the copy of his thesis for college, which became a bestseller. He was autographing away like mad, and As I looked down, I saw that there was a letter from a very important person underneath a wet bathing suit complimenting him on his book. And as we were introduced, I asked him, how are they going, referring to the books. And he looked up and grinned that grin, and he said, well, like hotcakes. He said, I'm seeing to that. So while all this was going on, there was an uproar upstairs and a scream from some young boy and a lot of laughter, and the president picked up his ears and, Teddy, he said, shaking his head, he said, serves him right. We never actually found out what happened to Teddy. It was probably too awful to talk about. And then just then, as we were standing in the room, the president's grandfather, Mr. Fitzgerald, burst in with a clipping from a Boston paper that had something less than kind to say about his stewardship as the city's mayor. And the president's face lit up with enjoyment, just like a light. Look at the things they're saying about me, Jack, his grandfather said. Lies. And the president read the article quickly, and he said, they're rats, Grandpa. That's what they are. That's right, boy, he said. Rats. And the president was putting his socks on now. He said, you're just 20 years ahead of your time, Grandpa. That was your trouble. That's right, boy, the old man said. And so then the president said, Grandpa, your time will come. You're going to be recognized. You wait and see. And you know what I'd do if I were you when that time comes? Disappear. And the old man picked up his paper and threw it at the boy, at the president, and walked out of the room. And when I walked out of that house late that night, I thought what a wonderful way for a family to be, and what a wonderful way to manage your family. And whenever I came back, it was always the same way. And always there was this one who stood out above the others with his thin frame and that wild mop of hair, in a restless way, easy Irish grin. And the oftener you saw him, the better you got to know him. You came to realize that if courage and a questioning intelligence and a real passion for life, infectious humor, ambition, and that graceful way of going were qualities to be admired, then he was the best man you'd ever know.
He was always very fond of children and young people.
Mrs. Alvin Anderson, formerly Elizabeth Dunn, who acted as governess for the younger Kennedy children while the family lived in England.
In the Kennedy family, they always ate together, the whole family, and many of the current events were discussed, of course, at the table. Oftentimes, the younger children would just sit there and listen because they weren't, of course, fully equipped to participate in the discussion the same as Joe and Jack and Kathleen and the others. So Jack would discuss the things that had already been talked about at the meals with the younger group and get their idea and impression so that come around dinner time, then they were able to participate in a small way and give their idea of things and then listen to the others correct them if they had made a wrong decision or a wrong impression.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy began his education at Dexter School in Brookline, Massachusetts, where he was born. And when he was nine, the Kennedys moved to New York and then to Bronxville, a suburb. He was only moderately studious, but he had the Kennedy essence. It was not yet refined, but it was partly there, the drive to succeed.
A Plea for a Raise by Jack Kennedy, dedicated to my father, Mr. J.P. Kennedy. Chapter 1. My recent allowance is 40 cents. This I use for airplanes and other playthings of my childhood. But now I am a scout, and I put away my childish things. Before, I would spend 20 cents of my 40 cents allowance, and in 5 minutes I would have empty pockets and nothing to gain and 20 cents to lose. When I'm a scout, I have to buy canteens, haversacks, blankets, searchlights, poncho things that will last 3 years. And I can always use it while I can't use a chocolate marshmallow sundae with vanilla ice cream. And so I put in my plea for a raise of 30 cents for me to buy scout things and pay my way more around. Finis. John Fitzgerald Francis Kennedy.
That letter, published in a brand new book, The Kennedy Years, hints at John Fitzgerald Kennedy's early determination. Lemoyne Billings remembers the Kennedy determination when they were both students at the Connecticut prep school, Choate.
I was living at that time in a building known as the Hill House, and I had gone out for the brief, which is the school yearbook, earlier than the president had. And really the best way and the easiest way to get on the brief was to go home and get all the poor, long-suffering merchants who had dealt with your family to give you ads for your yearbook way up in Connecticut. And I remember because I had recently been, and probably was the lowest ranking member of the brief, I was given the job of collecting the ads from those boys who were out for it, and I remember he had to bring his ads to me. And he was very, very successful and brought in many ads of meat markets and grocery stores, etc., in Bronxville and in Hyannisport, where they went for the summer. And that's actually the first time I really ever talked to him. And he, from then on, I don't know, we just clicked. I don't know what it was, but we got along very well, and I saw a good deal of him for the rest of that year. And the next year we roomed together.
Another friend, Torbert MacDonald, now a congressman, who roomed with him at Harvard, remembers how he carried his determination into Harvard.
He wanted very much to win a letter in swimming, and he was a very good swimmer, which he proved in saving those men during World War II from his PT boat. But he was very dedicated to want to make the varsity team to swim against Yale. And unfortunately, it came down to a choice between himself and a guy called Dick Tregaskis, who later, you may remember, wrote the Guadalcanal Diary. And he and Jack were good friends, but unfortunately Jack caught the grip or a cold, whatever it was. And the doctor, after he reported it, told him that he had to go to Stillman Infirmary. So he reported in, and after a day or so, I visited him each day, and he was getting restless and thinking about this time trial that was coming up. He thought he was getting out of shape. He thought the diet that the hospital was giving wasn't enough to sustain the efforts that would be necessary to put forth to beat Tregaskis. They were pretty evenly matched. So against my better judgment, in the daytime, I'd sneak him out, drive him to the indoor athletic building where the swimming pool was. He'd practice, I'd get him back in the car, I'd drive him back to the infirmary, and he'd pop back into bed, and whatever rounds the doctors made, he was always there. That was the outgoing part. The incoming part was that he wanted his diet buttressed by a little more food than he was getting on the diet that they had him when he was having this cold. So he asked me, and I did, bring him in cheeseburgers, fraps, that sort of thing, to keep his strength up for the time trial in which he would beat Tregaskis. Unlike most Frank Merriwell stories, which perhaps that sounds like, they did have the time trial, and he didn't make his letter against Yale.
Determination was, of course, only part of the Kennedy essence. Another part was humor, and a family nurse. Mrs. Luella Hennessy remembers a summer with the Kennedy family, when the Kennedy love of fun and humor was always present.
You know, all the Kennedy children are just great sailors. And during the sailboat races, they would want somebody to crew for them. And I guess I happened to be the only one available. So it depended upon who asked me first who I would crew for. I remember one particular day, Jack asked me first, so I crewed for him that afternoon. And we made out pretty well. And as we were nearing the finishing line, he was so anxious to finish that he suggested I jump overboard in order to lighten the weight of the boat. But it was only a suggestion. He really didn't make me jump overboard.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy used humor as a political weapon. When he was criticized for proposing to appoint his brother as Attorney General, he said he believed Robert ought to have some government legal experience before going into private practice. And he used humor as an instrument of friendship and affection. William Fay, who served with him during the Second World War and was appointed Undersecretary of the Navy, remembers how.
I was representing the Secretary of the Navy in the first NASA Security Council meeting in 1962 over in the Cabinet Room. And I was standing against the wall talking to J. Edgar Hoover. And the President walked in and he spotted me talking to J. Edgar Hoover, so he walked right over to J. Edgar. Now here's a room filled with all of his Cabinet officers and all the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the four Chiefs of the Services. And he walked over to J. Edgar and he said, Mr. Hoover, do you know the Undersecretary of the Navy? And J. Edgar said, oh, Red Fay and I are old friends. And he looked right at him and he says, obviously you've never looked up his record. And then he walked over and sat down and carried on really a momentous National Security Council meeting.
That was a later reflection of what Lemoyne Billings had observed earlier at Choate. And there were other characteristics observed at Choate, part of the Kennedy essence. The competitive spirit, first stimulated by a relationship between John Fitzgerald Kennedy and his brother, Joe.
They were very good friends, and they did an awful lot of things together. Certainly, I saw them up in the Cape in the summer, and they were competitive, very competitive in sailing against each other. And I would say that Jack was as good a sailor as Joe was, and they were competitive in those areas.
By the time he graduated from Choate, there was something of the rebel in John Fitzgerald Kennedy. He decided he would not follow the family pattern and attend Harvard, even though his father had gone there and his brother Joe was attending. He applied to Princeton and was accepted. However, illness forced him to drop out before the end of the first semester, and the following fall, he enrolled at Harvard. At first, his college career was undistinguished, and then in 1937, he visited Europe with Lemoyne Billings.
And he was exceedingly interested in what was going on in Europe, and he spent a great deal of his time asking questions. Even though he didn't really speak any foreign language well, he would find somebody who could interpret. And for instance, in France, he spent a lot of time talking to the peasants and talking to all different types of people to find out what they felt about the German threat. We found, as I remember, our general impression was at the time that the French weren't really too concerned about the German threat, that they felt very safe behind their Maginot Line. We continued on, and we went to Mussolini's Italy. I think that our impression at that time was that Mussolini had done a pretty good job. This was entirely different than what we found, at least we felt we found in Germany. And again, we were terribly interested in the Nazi movement and see what Hitler was doing. We even picked up some young soldiers. And the president spent a great deal of time catechizing them. And finally, after about a week with them, we were able to understand a little more of what they had to say. And they were very positive of Germany's power, and we had, in the end, a very bad impression of their conceit and their feeling about Germany. The president was intensely interested in his impressions, and I remember it would be very interesting to see the letters he wrote his father, because he did write down most of his impressions while he was on this European trip.
The visit to Europe seems to have been a turning point for John Fitzgerald Kennedy. It provoked an interest in foreign affairs which was never to be quenched. he took a leave of absence from Harvard in his junior year to work as an office boy in American embassies in London and Paris. And his father, by then ambassador to Great Britain, sent him to help American survivors of a torpedoed ocean liner. He went back to Harvard for a final year, which verged on brilliance. His Harvard roommate, Torbert MacDonald, reflects on the way in which the European experience matured John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Many people forget that it was the times, actually. We were in college in the class of 40. Of course, the war broke out, World War II in 1940. I know that I had traveled through Europe with him when his father was ambassador to Great Britain, Joseph P. Kennedy. And I know that he saw firsthand the temper of the times in Germany, in Italy. He went to Prague, which was in Czechoslovakia, sort of now like the wall is, a place of great dramatic espionage, etc. And obviously then returning, as we did, from war-torn Europe to come back to a very complacent America in 1940, it would have been strange if he hadn't taken a more serious view towards the world, because the world suddenly had turned much more serious than whether we were going to beat Yale at football, or whether the girls from Vassar were going to come down for the weekend, or the usual problems of collegiate life seemed to shrink in perspective.
He was graduated cum laude in political science and published his thesis as a book, Why England Slept. Yale Law School and enrolled in Stanford University's Graduate Business School, but he dropped out after 6 months to take a long tour of South America. When he came back, he was turned down by both the Army and Navy because of earlier back injuries. He worked to get himself in condition, was accepted by the Navy, and after a frustrating period of desk work, was assigned to patrol torpedo duty.
Well, I met him up in Melville, Rhode Island, at the Motor Torpedo Boat Training Center, and this was back in around the 1st of November of 1942.
This is William Fay.
We had gone through our first day indoctrination, and they gave us about an hour and a half free time at about 3:30 in the afternoon. So a group of us went down to play touch football, and this young slim fella came up, looked like maybe a junior or senior in high school, and asked if he could get in the ball game. And we said, well, if you can get another man so we can even up the sides, come on. So he came in and got in the ball game, and he had a different interpretation of the rules than I had, and his point prevailed. And so I was a little personally disturbed, because I'd taken the other side. So when we got back in the huddle, I said, all right, I'll take that skinny kid on the rest of these plays. And as it worked out, I was never able to take him, because he was all arms, elbows, and knees, and very well took care of himself. And the next day, when I went down to our first course in boat handling, the skipper of the PT boat that we were to take our boat handling exercise on was John Fitzgerald Kennedy, Lieutenant Junior Grade.
Another part of the Kennedy essence was at work in the service. This is Barney Ross, who served on PT-109 with John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
He was sensitive to the crew, the needs of the crew, who was afraid, who was goofing off, who was doing a job, who wasn't doing a job, without any rules and regulations or any format. Of course, we lived so closely together that most PT skippers were this way, but I mean, some fell down badly because they weren't able to adjust to this type of intimacy with the men, yet being able to retain their respect without going through the forms.
His commitment to winning the war represented a commitment to public service. That commitment began to grow roots inside him while he was recovering from the injuries he received when his PT boat was split by a Japanese destroyer. William Fay remembers the therapy John Fitzgerald Kennedy prescribed for himself and his fellow officers during that period of recuperation.
He kind of would hold a meet the press almost every evening before we go down to the officers' club to have a cocktail before dinner. Why, we'd go up to his tent, and there'd be about, oh, five or six of us would go up there, people who, most of them were in one way or another involved in his administration, like Jim Reed, who's the Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, and Bill Battle, who's a former ambassador to Australia, who just resigned as ambassador to Australia, and Barney Ross, who was on his boat, and a fellow named Tom Mason, who was United States Attorney in Virginia. We'd go up there, and maybe a few others would go up, and he would he'd challenge us with, well, we'll discuss tonight the subject of politics or whatever it might be, or some issue of the, why we're in the war, or what was the reason for us getting here, or why do, why are we out here fighting this particular area? And then we would discuss it, and the he would more or less guide the discussion. And this way, he kept us all conscious of the issues that were pertinent at the time and that were going to influence our future, and after the war was over, if we were fortunate enough to come back.
And Fay also remembers the impression he made on his fellow Navy men.
I can remember with Barney Ross one time making odds after, oh, I guess this was several weeks after we'd been involved with these discussions, and and we were thinking politically what the future was going to be for all of us, and we made books, so to speak, on what John Kennedy's chances were of being president of the United States. Now, this is back in 1943, and if I remember correctly, the odds were that about 10,000 to 1 that he would end up president of the United States, where the odds on either one of us being president of the United States, we figured, were somewhere between 1 or 2 million to 1.
Not long afterwards, the aggravation of his back injury, a siege of malaria, and a drop in his weight to 125 pounds forced John Fitzgerald Kennedy out of the Navy. At first, he thought about becoming a newsman and covered the founding of the United Nations in San Francisco for a newswire service. But he changed his mind, and in 1946, he entered a primary against nine other candidates for the Democratic nomination to Congress in the 11th Massachusetts District.
One night, I'm sitting home, a babysitter for my widowed sister and her eight children.
This is Dave Powers, taking a moment out from the Democratic Convention last August.
A knock came on the door, and when I answered it, it's sort of like a Horatio Alger story. In the semi-darkness, we probably had a 20-watt bulb in the entry, but in the semi-darkness, I could see this tall, thin, handsome fellow, and he reached out his hand and said, "My name is Jack Kennedy. I am a candidate for Congress. Will you help me?" So we sat in the parlor and talked about the campaign, the best way to campaign in that three-decker neighborhood. I sold papers over there for 10 years, and, you know, a newsboy gets to know a lot of people. And I ushered at St. Catherine's Church five masses every Sunday for 10. And I guess, you know, you see them at mass every Sunday. You know, in the history of American politics, when you think back of that fight in 1946, you realize that no man ever worked as hard or made as many sacrifices to be elected president. That, you know, he made you work hard because he was trying so hard himself all the time. And I think if you were trying to explain his success in maybe two sentences, they might be, to meet him is to like him, to know him is to want to help him.
Again, Lemoyne Billings.
I was very interested in the fact that he was running, and I remember I just went up there and I got out of the Navy. I got out rather late just to visit him and see what it was like to run for Congress. And he was living in a suite at a hotel up in Boston. And anybody who wanted to help or even just wanted to find out what was going on or even wanted to feel they could get something out of it just could come up into his open room and sit around. I remember very well I was staying with him that it wouldn't be unusual for me to go to bed at night with people sitting on my bed smoking cigars talking to the president and to wake up in the morning and find other people still sitting around smoking cigars. And in fact, the room was like Grand Central Station.
Again, Dave Powers.
You know, I was with him the very first night he ever talked to a group, and a group of Gold Star mothers. And he started to talk to this group, and he was no Curly, but he had an honest, sincere manner. And you could hear a pin drop in the hall. And you know, the hardest thing for a beginner is to bring a talk to a close. So he looked at them and he sort of stammered a bit. And then he looked back and he said, "I think I know how all you mothers feel, because my mother is a Gold Star mother too. And I've never seen a reaction like it in all my life." The several hundred women surrounded him, and standing in the background, I could hear them say, "He reminds me of my own John or Joe."
But there was more than one secret to the political success of John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
He had a fabulous memory for people that, when we'd talk, any time that I saw him, he'd bring up people that I had completely forgotten, and so I'd have to kind of fake it, you know, that, oh yeah, sure, it's old Charlie. But yeah, he remembered people and always seemed to have time for them. I know for a fact that he had standing orders with Mrs. Lincoln that any time any of the 109 crew called up that they should be, if possible, he'd like to see them. In fact, I've never known anyone from the 109 that didn't get in to see the president without too much trouble, if it was humanly possible.
At what moment did John Fitzgerald Kennedy decide the presidency of the United States lay within his reach? It was probably during those painful months in 1954 and 1955 when he was recovering from surgery on his back. That was the same time when he wrote a collection of biographies of courageous historical figures, Profiles in Courage, which won for him a Pulitzer Prize. He went to the 1956 National Democratic Convention and put before it the name of Adlai Stevenson. Stevenson won the presidential nomination without opposition and left the choice of a vice presidential candidate up to the convention. A minor Kennedy boom had already been generated, but he lost on the third ballot. However he felt about losing the vice presidential nomination, he now had national prestige.
The next time I actually saw him was in Wisconsin.
For a Roman Catholic, too young, too rich, and too ambitious, there was only one route to the Democratic presidential nomination, the state presidential primaries. He chose to go that route. Again, Barney Ross.
The night before the primary, the president, and it was a real interesting table. We had the president, the senator then, and Jackie Kennedy, and Bill Johnson, who was a motor machinist, and his wife, myself, and Red Fay in this German restaurant. We were all singing. This was about 10 o'clock at night, and the president had his clam chowder, and he didn't think Milwaukee clam chowder was right up to snuff, so he was talking about that. And we sang songs, and then he and Jackie left, and then the next time I saw him was at the inauguration in the snowstorm.
John Fitzgerald Kennedy won the Wisconsin primary, getting 56% of the vote. He also won the primaries in New Hampshire, West Virginia, and Oregon. Next came the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles.
You never saw a man so calm in all your life as the roll call of the states come in.
This is Dave Power.
He knew he had done the work, and now he was just there to pick up all the marbles. And as you remember, he needed 761 to win. And he had a scorecard, and he had, during the day, he had checked with Ken O'Donnell and his brother Bobby and Larry O'Brien to see if there are any changes. And he kept putting one down and adding one and erasing one. So finally, he is at 750. And he has Wyoming down for 9. And just then, he looked up and he could see his brother Teddy, now Senator Ted Kennedy, in the middle of the Wyoming delegation. And he started to put his shoes on and tighten his tie because Teddy had that famous Kennedy confident grin. And the president said, this could be it. And just then, Tracy McCracken, the chairman of the Wyoming delegation, grabbed the microphone and shouted, "Wyoming cast all 15 for the next president of the United States." And the president turned around and just said, "Get me Jackie at the Cape."
Between that moment and the moment on November 9th, 1960, when in Hyannisport, John Fitzgerald Kennedy learned that he was to become the 35th president of the United States, between those two moments, we can only see at a distance, a kaleidoscope. A young man resting on Cape Cod with his radiant young wife and shining little girl. A young man grinning and shaking hands from the back of an open convertible. A young man gawked at by bobby soxers, matrons, and grandmothers. A young man in a television studio, chopping the air with his hand to punctuate a point in a debate with his opponent. And a young man introducing a nation to a new way of pronouncing Cuber and Viga. There was a lip-splitting wind in Washington on Inauguration Day 1960. The sky had dumped 8 inches of snow on the streets, and the temperature was down to 22. But the sun was like a jewel, so bright that a poet had difficulty seeing what he had written especially for the occasion. Yes, there was poetry at the inauguration of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And there was eloquence, and there was drama, and there was also some comic relief.
The Navy had scoured the country for a real PT boat to put in the parade. And so here it was, the snowy day, and the whole crew was up there. And some of the crew, it was cold for all of us, but some of the crew brought along some preparations to keep us warm. And we were waiting on Louisiana Avenue for what seemed like hours. And getting more at ease as the day went along. And finally, I think we must have been the last thing in the parade. The PT boat comes along. We're all excited right up to the eyeballs. Here was our old skipper, the president, and the fact that we were even there. And so we were all lined up on at the review on the deck of the bow of the boat, and all grinning, big silly grins on our face, and we all what are we going to do when we get up to Jack? Johnson, you call a salute. So we're all the raunchiest crew you ever saw. The president about broke up when he saw us, when we're only separated by about 5 feet, and we were a little bit above him. And we could audibly hear the president say, "Look at those guys."
What did John Fitzgerald Kennedy bring to the White House? We are not here to assess the place of his administration in the history of the world. We will leave that to the historians. But his impact will be assessed by others, by dramatists, by novelists, by artists, by poets. He brought a style, a zest, a freshness, a glamour to an office we had grown accustomed to think was merely Olympian. It was still Olympian in the Kennedy administration, but it was human, too.
In the fall of 1962, I was taking care of his father, Mr. Joseph P. Kennedy, after he had had his unfortunate stroke.
This is Miss Luella Hennessy.
The president suggested that I bring his father to the White House for a little visit, so we went down in October 1962. Mr. Kennedy occupied the Lincoln Suite in the White House, and I mentioned to the president that it was such a very beautiful suite, and it was so rich in history. And he said, "Well, if you're just so mad about the Lincoln Suite, I tell you, if you get married during my administration, you can spend your honeymoon there."
I think that he enjoyed being able to make judgments of things that would affect every American citizen. I think that while it was a burden to him, he never complained of the burden. The only thing he ever complained about in the presidency that I can recall was the fact that he had to be staked in the White House, and as he once said to me, that he felt like the happiest inmate at Charlestown, that being our local jail here in Massachusetts.
Well, it's a great experience from an usher at St. Catherine's Church to an usher at the White House, but I enjoyed every bit of it. You know that every day I saw President Kennedy, he looked more like a president than the day before. He seemed to just grow more in stature that until that tragic day in Dallas, I always called him Mr. President because no one ever deserved it more than he. And every now and then to change the pace when I was bringing someone in, like the Shah of Iran, I would say to the president, our type Shah is in the cabinet room, Mr. President. And so he'd relax a bit. We had our type ambassador like David Ormsby Gore that he was very fond of, and we had our type everything.
What did John Fitzgerald Kennedy and Jacqueline Kennedy bring to the White House? They brought style, of that we're certain. They brought spirit. They brought animation. They brought a breath of something fresh. They gave us something to emulate.
Gosh, the president loved Mrs. Kennedy so much that he was always looking out for her welfare. That second last day, we spent 3 hours on motorcades and 6 hours flying. And a terrible, ordeal. And finally, when we got into Houston, I came up into the room and Jackie was resting, and the president was working on a speech. And he said, Dave, out of the crowd here compared to our last visit. And I said, well, Mr. President, just about as many came out to see you as they did during our last visit, but there was about 100,000 more for Jackie. And he looked at her and beamed and said, you see, you do help.
And then, a year ago today, an event occurred. An event so outside our frame of reference, so beyond our intellectual grasp, so out of joint with the humanness of John Fitzgerald Kennedy, that most of us never succeeded in understanding it. We could only tell pieces of it to each other. It was so big, so mountainous a fact, we could never quite get a grip on it.
It was just like a big hunk was cut right out of my life. I was so thrilled to be in Washington, I felt kind of guilty about being here in the first place. So I was knocking myself out to justify his faith in me. And actually, it's a good example of what he was always preaching, was that one man can make a difference, that you really ought to try. The whole meaning of what I was doing seemed to just drop out of the bottom, when he was killed. And in fact, our whole family, we just felt like packing up and going home. In fact, we almost did.
Anybody who knew him at all misses him terribly as a person. And all of us who didn't know him miss him as a person. I think that's evident, I think, in these sympathetic crowds that come to Washington to the cemetery and the mail Mrs. Kennedy gets and just the general reaction to his memory.
When is a life important? When its seed is planted? When its intellect begins to flower? Why was John Fitzgerald Kennedy important to you and me? We can only search for the answer.
He was very considerate of other people. He was, as everyone knows, of course, very funny. He was serious without it becoming oppressive. He was exciting. and he got more exciting, I think, as time went on.
Why was John Fitzgerald Kennedy important to you and me? We can only search for the answer.
Monitor has presented a special tribute to the late President John Fitzgerald Kennedy. 8 Who Knew Him. Your host was Frank Blair.